Chapter 3. Never underestimate the inclination to bolt. In the spring of 1982, I found myself on a payphone trying frantically to rent a helicopter so I could leave the 10-day silent Buddhist retreat where I'd been for exactly 15 hours. I'd returned from India a few years before and was searching for a spiritual path that did not include a frizzy-haired, beetle-sucking man who called himself the incarnation of God. My therapist, Kate, had urged me to sign up for the retreat, but she forgot to mention that I'd have to spend 15 hours a day meditating, and I'd forgotten to ask. Kate also neglected to tell me that I couldn't talk or make eye contact with anyone the entire time. The guy on the phone asked me where I was. In the middle of the desert, I answered, Joshua Tree National Park. There are no helicopter pads there, lady, and even if there were, you're talking a lot of money, thousands of dollars. It was the second day of the retreat, and I felt as if I was insane. In the shockingly silent meditation hall the night before, I had images of standing up and yelling, douchebag, douchebag, like someone with Tourette syndrome. Clearly, I needed to leave. I tried to think of alternatives to renting a helicopter. Hitchhiking, begging, walking. None were feasible. Of the 150 people at the retreat, who I was now convinced were a cult of Buddhist zombies walking in slow, meditative stupor around the grounds, I knew no one. My dorm room with 15 women and one bathroom was crowded and stuffy. And despite the precept of nonviolence, I was ready to inflict great harm upon the snorer whose cot was next to mine, bang her over the head with a large cactus. Spending 10 days stuck in my own mind felt like being locked up in a cramped cell with a crazy person and not having any way out. $2,500, the helicopter rental guy muttered. And since my salary as an avocado and cheese sandwich maker at a local health food store in Santa Cruz was $600 a month, flying out of the retreat was out of the question. Buddhist teacher Pema Chodron writes, "Never underestimate the inclination to bolt." I tell that to my students on the first night of the retreats. They laugh. They think, "Me? I won't bolt. This thing with food has got me so down that I will do anything, anything to resolve it." On the first night, they are too tired from having traveled across the country or an ocean or two. But by the second day, they're making plans to fly home. Or they decide they're bored and there's no new information here. Often they decide using food isn't so bad after all and wonder if they can get their money back and leave for a cruise instead. I tell them the helicopter story. I tell them that if compulsive eating is anything, it's a way we leave ourselves when life gets hard, when we don't want to notice what's going on. Compulsive eating is a way we distance ourselves from the way things are when they are not how we want them to be. I tell them that ending the obsession with food is all about the capacity to stay in the present moment, to not leave themselves. I tell them they don't have to make a choice between losing weight and doing this. Weight loss is the easy part. Anytime you truly listen to your hunger and fullness, you lose weight. But I also tell them that compulsive eating is basically a refusal to be fully alive. No matter what we weigh, those of us who are compulsive eaters have anorexia of the soul. We refuse to take in what sustains us. We live lives of deprivation, and when we can't stand it any longer, we binge. The way we are able to accomplish all of this is by the simple act of bolting, of leaving ourselves hundreds of times a day. But that doesn't touch the sudden realization and the subsequent panic that they really don't want to sit in the center of their own lives. It's one thing to say you want to stop using food to numb yourself, to be miserable about the size of your body, to feel as if you're killing yourself with double cheeseburgers and fries. But slowing down, asking yourself what is actually going on when you want to eat, when you aren't hungry, watching how you inhale 3 muffins before you even realize you're eating, that's going too far. There is something about accepting the unpredictable fragility of this life that is just too much. So the very minute they begin feeling or sensing or thinking something that is uncomfortable, they want to get out of Dodge. There are many ways to bolt: walking out the door, renting a helicopter, distracting yourself from your pain by doing 1,000 different things, thinking about something else, blaming your mother, blaming someone else, getting into a fight, comparing yourself to other people, dreaming about life in the future, recalling life in the past, never getting deeply involved, eating, spending your life trying to lose weight or figure it all out, resigning yourself to the endless struggle with food so you never have to take the dive into the meaning of it all, or discover who you are, what your relationships can be without the drama of food. Staying where you are with what you are feeling or seeing or sensing is the first step in ending the obsession with food. And although it seems as if ending the obsession is what we all want to do, we actually want to keep it more, and for very good reasons. Obsession gives you something to do besides having your heart shattered by heart-shattering events, like watching your children get sick, like living while your spouse dies, like being with your parents as they get old, wear diapers, forget their own names. Obsession gives you a plane ticket out of a particular kind of heartbreak. It gives you a helicopter ride out of the desert. It creates a parallel world, a hologram of emotions, passions, breathtaking reversals. It gives you the illusion of feeling everything without having to be vulnerable to anything. In the drama of obsession, you are the star, the co-star, the director, the producer. Other people, even your children, are only stand-ins, cardboard props. When you are crazed about a binge, for example, you become so focused on getting the food in your mouth that you leave your child in the car, as one of my students did, and forget she's there. There is madness and obsession, yes, but its value is that it drowns out the madness of life, especially now, when we're living on the verge of destroying ourselves and our environment. Not bolting, being awake without being drugged by food, alcohol, work, sex, money, drugs, fame, or in denial about the crisis we are actually in, is asking a lot. I used to think, well, okay, sometimes I still do, that the less I showed up, the less it would hurt when I lost everything, when people I loved died, when things fell apart. Sometimes I shock myself. Sometimes I wish my husband Matt would just die and get it over with. In my most regressed moments, seeing events through the eyes of a child, I live between fearing doom and wishing for it, between worrying that Matt will die every time he walks out the door and convincing myself that I will be relieved when he does. This is the very thinking that evolved into the obsession with food 30 years ago. The belief, unconscious as it was, that I couldn't handle, couldn't tolerate, didn't have thick enough skin or a resilient enough heart to withstand what was in front of me without fragmenting. Which is another way of saying that obsession is a way of organizing our lives so that we never have to deal with the hard part, the part that happens between being 2 years old and dying. While I realize that it's not all hard, and that some people, Matt and perhaps one or two more, don't see it this way, we compulsive eaters wouldn't have an obsession with food if we believed that life was tolerable without it. The glitch here is that it's not life in the present moment that is intolerable. The pain we are avoiding has already happened. We are living in reverse. It's not that there isn't pain in the present moment. Every day I get letters from people about just making it through another day. This morning I got a letter from one of my students who told me that her mother got her hair done on Thursday like she always did, and by Friday she was completely delusional and needed to be checked into a mental health facility. She said, "My father is torn apart. They've been married for 60 years, and I have no idea how I'm going to get through this." The answer to "I have no idea how I am going to get through this" is you allow yourself to sob, to heave, to feel as if your heart has a boulder crashing through it. You sit with your father. You listen to his sorrow. You get help from your friends. And you notice that at the end of every day, you are still alive. And you notice that when you don't use food to shut yourself down, to leave your body, you actually feel more alive. That feeling anything, even grief, is different from what you thought it would be. That when you don't leave yourself, a different life is lived. One that includes vulnerability and tenderness and fragility and changes the landscape, makes it verdant, wider, breathtaking, of life as you know it. To the extent that we go into survival mode, "I can't feel this, I won't feel this, it hurts too much, it will kill me," we are slipping into baby skins, old forms, familiar selves. Young children, especially infants, mediate the pain of loss or abandonment or abuse through the body. There is no difference between physical and emotional pain. If the pain is too intense and the defenses are too weak, a child will become psychotic and or die. It is life-saving for a child to develop defenses that allow her to leave a situation she can't physically leave by shutting down her feelings or turning to something that soothes her. But if as adults we still believe that pain will kill us, we are seeing through the eyes of the fragile selves we once were and relying on the exquisite defense we once developed, bolting. Obsessions are ways we leave before we are left, because we believe that the pain of staying would kill us. But the person who would be killed, the "I in the pain is big and I am small" belief, is an idea, a memory, an image of yourself left over from childhood. You already felt destroyed. That was then. You will never be that small again. You are not dependent on someone else to hold you, to love you so that you can continue breathing. Staying requires awareness of the desire to bolt, of the stories you are telling yourself about the need to bolt. Staying means recognizing that when you want to bolt, you are living in the past. You are taking yourself to be someone who no longer exists. Staying requires being curious about who you actually are when you don't take yourself to be a collection of memories, when you don't infer your existence from replaying what happened to you, when you don't take yourself to be the girl your mother, father, brother, teacher, lover didn't see or adore, when you sense yourself directly, immediately, right now, without preconception, who are you? When you stay, you question what you've never questioned, the you take yourself to be, the you who is not your past, not your habits, not your compulsions. Anything becomes possible, even living through extraordinary pain. When I am afraid Matt will die when he walks out the door, I am afraid that I won't survive without him. When I want him to die to get it all over with, I want to stop the pain of anticipating the pain. As long as I believe that pain is bigger than me, as long as I define being open and vulnerable as being vulnerable to annihilation, I believe in an image of myself, that I am someone who can be annihilated. And when I believe this, I bolt from different situations by engaging in various mind-altering and body-numbing activities. I shut myself down or walk out the door when pain threatens to destroy me, which is in any situation that involves another human being or whose outcome I cannot control. I live an autistic existence. But something else is happening as well. The refusal to accept and therefore engage in life as it is, in the way things are. People get old, get sick, and die, or they die suddenly, or their deaths drag on forever. My friend Tori is dying a slow, excruciatingly painful death of bone cancer. 8 friends have died of breast cancer. Polar bears are dying. Honeybees are vanishing. The oceans are drying up. There is a part of me that wants my money back, that wants to say, I didn't sign up for this. I don't like the way this whole thing is set up and I won't participate in it. Stephen Levine, a Buddhist teacher, says that hell is wanting to be somewhere different from where you are, being one place and wanting to be somewhere else, being constantly agitated, another word for non-accepting, about the inevitable, being in a relationship with someone and refusing to surrender to the love because you don't want to give yourself to something you will eventually lose. That's called living in hell, refusing to love because you want the end game to be different than it is, wanting life to be different from what it is. That's also called leaving without leaving, dying before you die. It's as if there is a part of you that so rails against being shattered by love that you shatter yourself first. Another name for this pattern? Obsession. When one of the first things that happens at my retreat is that my students begin fighting with me, the setup of the retreat, the meeting times, I see this as the initial descent into Stephen's definition of hell. I'm here, but I wish I wasn't. There must be an easier way. I want my money back. I don't like the rules of this game. But the real don't like is, I don't like that I have this obsession with food, and I don't want to do what I need to do to work with it. I thought I did, but now that I'm here, I've changed my mind. I'd rather go on another diet. I'd rather pretend that this is all about willpower and eating the right foods. I'd rather lose weight 1,000 more times than truly see myself. Do the work of being aware of myself, knowing myself, discovering what I really believe about life, about love, about God. The desire to leave the retreat is an expression of the desire to leave the obsession itself, to pretend that it's a minor problem that can be fixed in a few weeks with slight adjustments in exercise and portion control. It's a way of saying, this is not my life, this is not my problem, there is no meaning for me here. But as the days pass, the vortex of the retreat gets stronger, and something unexpected happens. My students give up the fight because they become aware of something they never thought existed. That which is beyond the pain. That which the pain passes through. One student told me that she waited to come to a retreat for 3 years, until her kids were old enough for her to be away for 6 consecutive days. But when she finally arrived, she wanted to leave immediately. She dismissed what was happening, telling herself there was nothing new being taught. She called the airlines to check on a ticket home. She thought about taking a train, about renting a car and driving cross-country. She writes, by the second day, I already felt jaded about what was happening here. I thought I know this already. This stuff is basic. I don't need to be here, and I'm not going to get anything out of it. I wanted to leave, but then I realized how my jadedness was actually resistance to staying with myself. Seeing this broke me open. I suddenly saw that that jaded attitude permeates my life. The dismissive attitude keeps me gravitating towards the spiritual pieces that are easy and accessible and feel good. It keeps me protected from what I don't know. There is no mystery in the jadedness. No thrill of discovery. no real life. The practice of bringing myself back to the present moment instead of careening around in my head is not one that comes easy to me. On the one hand, I work myself so hard in my career that I feel justified in wanting an easy, relaxed, convenient spirituality. Spirituality that makes me feel better instantly. But I've had a shift here in seeing that real consistent practice of eating, breathing, showing up moment after moment. That is my true work. This is what a life can be. I see the commitment that staying will require, and I understand that it is not the same painful, shoulder to the grindstone, vitality squelching, but approval garnering work that I spend so much of my time doing. I see that doing this work requires humility and a willingness to return to myself over and over and over. To be interested in what's actually here without the overlay of my past. But having now tasted what it's like to feel like my internal landscape is not strewn with landmines, that everything is truly workable and is in fact lovable and worthy of love, I don't want to go back to the way I lived before. To stay, you have to believe there's something worth staying for, and then you have to bring yourself back. Again and again. The initial glimpse of wonder, of love, of possibility, of expansion becomes a commitment to returning, to bringing yourself back each time you bolt. I saw an interview recently with Stephen Levine of the aforementioned Hell Definition and his wife of 30 years, Andrea. I met Stephen over dinner in Santa Cruz in 1978 when he was young and vital, and so was I. He taught death and dying workshops, traveled everywhere, lectured to packed audiences of 500 people or more. Now he is so frail that he can't walk or make a fist with his hands. Andrea has leukemia and is having seizures. Each of them said they weren't afraid of dying. Each of them said, I'd like her, him, to die first, so that she doesn't have to suffer dying alone when I am gone. Geez, I thought. This is a bit different from my crazy desire for Matt to die, so that I can get the pain of anticipating his death over with. They want the other to die first. They are wishing for the pain of being left, so that their partner will be spared that same pain. It's the opposite of bolting. It's walking straight into the pain with the understanding that there are worse things in life than a broken heart. That something exists beyond, something that completely saturates any pain, something that holds the pain, is bigger than it is, and there is no fighting with either the pain or the thing that saturates it. I realized then how much and with what I still fight. Not just with death and loss. There is also the matter of my thighs that now look like yesterday's oatmeal, or my neck that looks, as writer Anne Lamott says, like the Utah desert is upholstered on it. I can't quite get over it. I'm in my 50s, and while I realize that's not old, I can't read labels in the grocery store without my glasses. The other day, I bought a bar of chili chocolate, instead of coffee chocolate, a grave offense. I realized that getting work done is always a possibility, but then I'd feel as if I was wearing a mask, fighting the inevitable, bolting from gravity. I say I believe in something deeper, something that doesn't die, and some of the time I call that something God. But every now and then I forget what I know and want to bolt all over again. At some point, it's time to stop fighting with death, my thighs, and the way things are. And to realize that compulsive eating is nothing but bolting from multiple versions of the above. The obsession will stop when the bolting stops. And at that point, we might answer, as spiritual teacher Catherine Ingram did, when someone asked how she allowed herself to tolerate deep sorrow, I live among the brokenhearted. They allow it. Chapter 4. It's not about the weight, but it's not not about the weight. A few years ago, I received a letter from someone who'd included a Weight Watchers ribbon on which was embossed, "I lost 10 pounds. Underneath the gold writing, the letter writer added, "And I still feel like crap." We think we're miserable because of what we weigh. And to the extent that our joints hurt and our knees ache and we can't walk 3 blocks without losing our breath, we probably are physically miserable because of extra weight. But if we've spent the last 5, 20, 50 years obsessing about the same 10 or 20 pounds, something else is going on, something that has nothing to do with weight. My friend Sally went to a wedding in Finland a few years ago and met a distant cousin of hers who was furious with me. The cousin said she'd read my books, followed my approach, and gained 100 pounds. She thought I was a charlatan, a fake, a louse. I didn't blame her. If I'd gained 100 pounds while believing I was following an expert's advice, I'd be furious too. 100 pounds! My response to Sally's cousin was to say as kindly as I could, and with the safety of thousands of miles between us, that I realized she thought she was listening to me, but I don't advocate eating compulsively. And gaining 100 pounds is nothing but. Most people are so glad to read about, hear about, and then begin any approach that doesn't focus on weight loss as its main agenda that they take it to be licensed to eat without restraint. Aha, they say. Someone finally understands that it's not about the weight. It's never been about the weight. It's not even about food. Great, they say. Let's eat. A lot. Let's not stop. And the truth is that it's not about the weight. It's never been about the weight. When a pill is discovered that allows people to eat whatever they want and not gain weight, the feelings and situations they turn to food to avoid will still be there, and they will find other, more inventive ways to numb themselves. In Groundhog Day, when he realized he wasn't going to gain weight by eating 1,000 cherry pies, Bill Murray ate like there was no tomorrow, since in the movie there wasn't. But the charge dissipated as soon as he realized that he could have as much food as he wanted without the usual consequences. When you take the charge away, all that's left is a no big deal piece of cherry pie. And when you finish the pie, the thing that had nothing to do with the pie that drove you to it is still there. In the last year, I've gotten letters or worked with students who have mortgage their houses to pay for a gastric bypass operation and then gain back the weight they lost, borrowed money, a lot of it, from a relative for liposuction and then discovered that they still hated their thighs, lost 100 pounds and were so disappointed that it didn't fix what was broken that they gained back the weight. Either you want to wake up or you want to go to sleep. You either want to live or you want to die. It's not about the weight. But it's also not about the weight. The reality of sheer poundage and its physical consequences cannot be denied. Some people at my retreats can't sit in a chair comfortably. They can't walk up a slight incline without feeling pain. Their doctors tell them their lives are in danger unless they lose weight. They need knee replacements, hip replacements, lap band surgeries. The pressure on their hearts, their kidneys, their joints is too much for their body to tolerate and still function well. So it is about the weight, to the extent that weight gets in the way of basic function, of feeling, of doing, of moving, of being fully alive. The in-your-face reality of the obesity epidemic, the fact that 75% of Americans are overweight, gets endless news coverage. Statistics about weight, the new drugs that are being discovered, the possibility of an obesity gene, all are discussed ad infinitum in the media. No one can argue that being 100 pounds overweight is not physically challenging. Yet. The bottom line, whether you weigh 340 pounds or 150 pounds, is that when you eat when you are not hungry, you are using food as a drug. Grappling with boredom or illness or loss or grief or emptiness or loneliness or rejection. Food is only the middleman, the means to the end, of altering your emotions, of making yourself numb, of creating a secondary problem when the original problem becomes too uncomfortable, of dying slowly rather than coming to terms with your messy, magnificent, and very, very short, even at 100 years old, life. The means to these ends happens to be food, but it could be alcohol, it could be work, it could be sex, it could be cocaine, surfing the internet, talking on the phone. For a variety of reasons we don't fully understand, genetics, temperament, environment, those of us who are compulsive eaters choose food, not because of its taste, not because of its texture or its color. We want quantity, volume, bulk. We need it, a lot of it, to go unconscious, to wipe out what's going on. The unconsciousness is what's important, not the food. Sometimes people will say, but I just like the taste of food. In fact, I love the taste. Why can't it be that simple? I overeat because I like food. But when you like something, you pay attention to it. When you like something, love something, you take time with it. You want to be present for every second of the rapture. Overeating does not lead to rapture. It leads to burping and farting and being so sick that you can't think of anything but how full you are. That's not love, that's suffering. Weight, too much or too little, is a byproduct. Weight is what happens when you use food to flatten your life. Even with aching joints, it's not about food. Even with arthritis, diabetes, high blood pressure, it's about your desire to flatten your life. It's about the fact that you've given up without saying so. It's about your belief that it's not possible to live any other way, and you're using food to act that out without ever having to admit it. This morning I received this letter. Each time I start trying to follow what you say, I get afraid and then go running back to the security of the Weight Watchers point system. And every time I try points, I inevitably fail a week later and spiral into a new rash of binges and beating myself up. My main concern is that I don't know how to face the actual deficiency in the rest of my life. I am a first-year associate at a large law firm in New York. By all accounts, I am going places and will be something someday. But for now, it's a lot of skill building, like managing nitty-gritty tasks and doing document review and never being able to sink my teeth into anything. I can manage my eating pretty well during the day, but at night I return home unsatisfied and a binge results. I can easily see the direct connection between this emptiness and my eating habits. Your books capture it perfectly. And I do just need to stare my frustration with my job and my career in the face instead of distracting myself from it with food. I just don't know how to deal with this when I have to be in this job at a minimum another 8 months to get my bonus and likely another 12 months until my boyfriend completes his stint and we can think about moving somewhere else. Intellectually, I can reconcile being in this job with an overall career arc. But on a day-to-day basis, it's just aggravating. I guess I'm writing this more so I can disabuse these binges of their power. But even with this clarity, I am not sure I can really make paying attention to hunger a sustainable pattern if this job continues to sap me of my energy. So what's a girl to do when she's destined to be someone, but in the meantime feels as if she is no one special? How does she face what she doesn't want to face without eating? That's really the dilemma. I don't want to be where I am, and so I'm eating to wipe out the aggravation. How can I feel the aggravation without eating to make myself feel better? Let's suppose that she keeps eating. Every night she comes home and binges. Soon she gains weight, then more weight. Perhaps she gains so much weight that her joints ache, her back hurts. The pressure on her knees becomes painful and then excruciating. Instead of worrying about being no one, she is now worried about getting her knees replaced. She has joined the ranks of the obese, and it looks to her and all the world that her problem is her weight. That if she could only lose weight, her body would function well. This is probably true. And she would be happy. This is not true. But her problem is not about the food she consumes. Her problem, though it eventually would become excess weight, is not weight. It's that she doesn't know, no one ever taught her, how to face, as she calls it, her deficiency, the emptiness, the dissatisfaction. I see four choices. The first is to keep doing what she's doing. That's the choice that most of us make most of the time. Caught in a conundrum, in a paradox, I need to stay here, but I don't want to. Staying here makes me unhappy. Being unhappy makes me eat. We usually make a hoopla out of compulsive eating and call that the problem. Our lack of willpower, our nightly binges, our expanding body sizes. And while with enough weight gain, it really does become a problem that needs to be addressed, it's a problem we've manufactured so we don't have to deal with the unknown. Her second choice is to leave her job and find something she wants to do now. A more difficult choice, especially if being an attorney is her passion, which at the beginning requires working at tasks that don't thrill her. And her third choice, the one with which she is grappling, is to untangle the knot she is calling deficiency. To demystify the emptiness she runs away from night after night. If the nighttime feelings were no longer frightening, there'd be no need to turn to a drug to numb them. Deficiency, emptiness, they're just words. Names that evoke scary thoughts, which then evoke scary feelings. And both the thoughts and the feelings are based on her idea of what is supposed to be happening that isn't. I'm supposed to be someone special, and here I am doing grunt work and reviewing other people's documents. This isn't what I dreamed about. I'm never going to amount to anything. My life is a waste. What if it's always like this? What if my dreams are just pipe dreams? I should have known this was going to happen. I should have listened to my eighth grade teacher, Mrs. Simpkinson, when she told me I'd never amount to anything. Oh, I feel so empty. I feel deficient, flawed, like I am and never will be enough. I need to eat. Deficiency sounds awful, but is it? What does it actually feel like? Is it a big hole in her stomach, her chest? Does it feel like everything is dropped away and she's holding on to the edge of a huge abyss about to fall in? If she stops trying to hold on and lets herself fall, what would happen? Remember that all of these are images in her mind. She's not really holding on to the edge of an abyss. She's probably sitting in a chair. She wouldn't actually fall anywhere if, in her mind, she let herself fall. Is emptiness the experience of space, or is it something else? If it's space, then she feels it directly in her body where it resides. She might notice if there's anything that is actually scary about it, or if it's just a story she is telling herself. There is a whole universe to discover between I'm feeling empty and turning to food to make it go away. The problem of weight is predictable. We know what to do when we have that problem. Beat ourselves up, make ourselves wrong, eat fewer donuts. But staying with the emptiness, entering it, welcoming it, using it to get to know ourselves better, being able to distinguish the stories we tell ourselves about it from the actual feeling itself, that's radical. Imagine not being frightened by any feeling. Imagine knowing that nothing will destroy you, that you are beyond any feeling, any state, bigger than, vaster than, that there is no reason to use drugs, because anything a drug could do would pale in comparison to knowing who you are, to what you can understand, live, be, just by being with what presents itself to you in the form of the feelings you have when you get home from work at night. Her fourth choice, accepting the situation, dropping the resistance to doing grunt work, understanding that this is the way things are for now, and being vigilant about bringing her attention to the present moment again and again. Acceptance represents the basic challenge of compulsive eating, the reason why it's not about the weight, why people lose 10 pounds and still feel like crap. The lack of acceptance and the lawyer's unhappiness are synonymous. She is assuming, absolutely counting on the fact that when she gets to be someone special, she will no longer feel deficient and no longer be haunted by emptiness. I've thought that too, about 100 million times. It's called the, when I get thin, change jobs, move, find a relationship, leave this relationship, have money, blues. It's called the if only refrain. It's called postponing your life and your ability to be happy to a future date when then, oh then, you will finally get what you want and life will be good. In my books, Feeding the Hungry Heart and When Food is Love, I've written about the stories of people who lost weight and were still miserable, who got what they thought they wanted most and found that joy still eluded them. Because, and yes, I know this is a cliche, but it is a cliche because it's actually true. Miserable and happy are not functions of what you have, what you look like, or what you achieve. I'm not exactly proud to say that I've been miserable anywhere, with anything, with anyone. I've been miserable standing in a field of 1,000 sunflowers in southern France in mid-June. I've been miserable weighing 80 pounds and wearing a size 0. And I've been happy wearing a size 18. Happy sitting with my dying father. Happy being a switchboard operator. It's not about the weight. It's not about the goal. It's not about being thin or being someone special or getting there. Those are fantasies in your mind, and they are all in the future, a future that never comes. Because when your goals are reached, they will be reached in the right now. And in the right now, you will still be you, doing the same things you do now. You will stand up, walk around, get root canals, open the refrigerator door, sleep, feel happy, feel devastated, feel lonely, feel loved, get old, die. But it's not about the weight. Because if you keep using food as a drug, if you keep distracting yourself by creating a weight problem, then you need to attend to your weight in order to stand up, walk around, open doors, sleep, feel happy, feel devastated, feel love, get old, die, with any degree of attention, wholeheartedness, presence. If you keep slapping another problem on top of the freshness of life itself, all you see is what you've slapped onto it. You cannot ignore a problem just because it's one you manufactured. At some point, it becomes about the weight. When you can't live the rest of your life with ease, the weight itself needs to be addressed. Not so that you can become supermodel thin. Not so that you can look like an image in your mind that has nothing to do with your body, your age, your life. You need to address the weight because without addressing it, you don't actually live. You schlep yourself from place to place out of breath. Sitting is painful. Flying is torturous. Going to the movies is challenging. You become so burdened with the problem you've created that your life becomes small and your focus becomes narrow. Life becomes about your limitations, what you can and cannot do, how much you can hide, how ashamed you are of yourself. You close down your senses, you leave the world of sound, of color, of laughter, in favor of a reality you've created yourself. If you keep using food as a drug, if your life becomes about your weight, you miss everything that is not related to your weight problem. You die without ever having lived. Here is the letter I wrote to no one in particular who is hoping to be someone special and creating a weight problem in the meantime. It seems as if you chose this career and therefore this career arc. Can you accept that? Not as resignation, which is how people define acceptance, not as a sense of victimhood. Poor me, I can't do anything but accept the situation. But as the willingness to stop defining your tasks as a means to an end, and instead inhabit what you yourself have chosen. What if this is exactly what you're supposed to be doing, because it is what you are doing? What if each nitty-gritty task is perfection itself, and you keep missing it because you're looking for something else? It's like washing the dishes. If you focus on getting the dishes done so that your kitchen will be clean, you miss everything that happens between dirty and clean. The warmth of the water, the pop of the bubbles, the movements of your hand. You miss the life that happens in the middle zone, between now and what you think your life should be like. And when you miss those moments because you'd rather be doing something else, you're missing your own life. Those moments are gone. You will never get them back. Even when you become something because they were right, you really were going places. Even when you arrive at being someone because you are where you were going, your life may not be any better if you haven't learned to be awake, alive, now, to take this moment for what it is. It's just as easy to be miserable when you are someone special as when you are no one in particular. Because even someone special still has to live in her own skin and deal with boredom, rejection, loneliness, disappointment. Even someone special comes home at night and does what the nobodies do, falls asleep alone. You might as well learn how to pay attention now, how to inhabit the life you've chosen, how to take up every inch of your skin. Occupy the space in this body you were given. It's your place, only yours. The writer Annie Dillard says, "How you spend your days is how you spend your life." Be unwaveringly honest. Ask yourself how you want to spend your days. Since you're going to be reviewing documents anyway, why not be aware of your breath and the ticking clock while you are doing it? Whatever it offers, the reality of your day-to-day life has to be better than the self-inflicted misery you are creating through the stories you are telling yourself. It has to be better than the nightly binges and throwing yourself into the cycle of self-loathing and promises to stop eating so much. Come back. Break the trance. Pay attention to your breath, your arms, your legs. Listen to sounds, the scrape of a chair, the whir of the copy machine. Notice colors, the royal blue of a coworker's dress, the coffee stain on your boss's tie. Wake up to the riot of life around you every second. The singer Pearl Bailey said, "People see God every day. They just don't recognize him." What if every day was a chance to see a new version of God? What if what you needed was right in front of you and you were not recognizing it? You already have everything you need to be content. Your real work, despite the corporate ladder you are climbing, is to do whatever it takes to realize that. And then it won't matter if you're someone special or no one in particular, because you'll be fully alive in every moment, which is, I imagine, all you ever wanted from going places to be someone, or from being thin. Chapter 5, Beyond What's Broken. Somewhere along the line, I started believing that the purpose of living was to pass the test I'd be given when I died. At the moment of my last breath, there would be a judgment hearing at which I'd be forced to review my life. Given my propensities towards taking the biggest piece of anything and amassing large quantities of earrings when so much of the world lived on less than a dollar a day, there would be no doubt about the verdict. I was going to hell. Unless, of course, I spent the remaining days of my life trying to be selfless like Mother Teresa and go without lip gloss. Or at the very least, gave away all my material possessions and lived in a house made of grass, sleeping on a mattress made of hemp, wearing clothes made of recycled bottles, and eating a diet of beneficial microorganisms found in dirt. When I first meet people who come to my retreat, I see those same beliefs funneled through the relationship with food, as if punishing themselves with dietary rigors will make up for something inherently damaged, fundamentally wrong with their very existence. Being thin becomes the test. Losing weight becomes their religion. They must suffer humiliation and torment. They must enroll in an endless succession of dietary privations, and then and only then will they be pure, be holy, be saved. When I was on Weight Watchers in the early 70s, I was staying at a friend's house for a week. They would sit down to their meals of meatloaf and mashed potatoes, and I would sit down to whatever was on my diet. One evening, I made dinner out of the remaining allowable foods for the day. 2 servings of cold tomato sauce, using the stove was not one of my specialties, and a serving of ricotta cheese. I was scooping my dinner into a bowl when my friend Alan said to me, "Is that really what you want to eat? Cold tomato sauce with a lump of cold cheese?" "Yes," I said, "of course." But the truth was that no was not an option. Eating what I wanted was not allowed. Wanting what I wanted was not allowed. I needed to sacrifice, atone, make up for being myself, for being fat. The most difficult part of teaching people to respect and listen to their bodies is overcoming their conviction that there is nothing to respect. They can't find any place in them that is whole or intact. And so when they hear me say relax, when they hear me say trust yourself, they feel as if I am asking them to throw themselves to the wolves, banishing them to wild and ferocious brokenness. The possibility that there is a place in them, in everyone that is unbroken, that has never gained a pound, never been hungry, never been wounded, seems like a myth as far-fetched as the Sumerian goddess Inanna ascending to earth after hanging on a meat hook in hell. But then I ask them about babies. I ask them to remember their own children and how they come into the world already gorgeous and utterly deserving of love. They nod their heads. They realize that brokenness is learned, not innate, and that their work is to find their way back to what is already whole. A few months ago, I lost my face. It wasn't the honey I lost my car keys kind of losing. I woke up one morning to find that my face had been replaced by a beach ball-sized orb, a wavy hole beneath my nose, formerly known as my mouth, and 2 swollen protrusions below my forehead, out of which the slits of my erstwhile crescent-shaped eyes could see. Red, oozy bumps, the result of an allergic reaction earlier in the week, occupied the area where my skin had recently lived. And since our biannual retreat was in its 2nd of 6 days, and since its remote location made it impossible to leave and return for medical attention in time for the next session, there was nothing to do but spend the week facing 100 people without my face. On the 3rd day, my face was twice the size as the day before, and the bumps now felt like 1,000 stinging bees. On the 4th day, I could only open one eye. "Is it hard to look at me?" I asked one of my co-teachers. Yes, he said. Do I look deformed? Uh-huh, he said, like Elephant Man, but only when I first see you. Then I get used to it. I wish I could say that I accepted my new look with unclouded equanimity and Buddha-like serenity. But my constitutional predilections toward drama and hysteria propelled me in their well-trodden grooves. I touched my face at 30-second intervals to see if it had gotten better. I caused myself immense suffering by refusing to believe this was happening. I wanted my face back. Now. It wasn't fair. It wasn't that I disagreed with the idea of loss, or that certain losses, death for example, were part of life, but losing my face? That was going too far. When I saw anything that breathed, a person, a dog, a lizard, I thought, you still have your face. What could you have to complain about? I thought about all the people with facial deformities, about the real Elephant Man. I thought, if I ever get my face back, I will never take my cheeks for granted. I will never complain about the crow's feet, never have one more speck of disregard about the sunspots, the wrinkles, and their offspring. I will wake up every morning and greet my countenance with enthusiasm and gratitude, as if it was as miraculous as the virgin birth. And then slowly, because I was teaching a retreat on looking below the surface of things, I began to notice that nothing was actually wrong. The noticing was grudging at first, as if I was a 3-year-old throwing a tantrum about losing her favorite doll and had become quite fond of making a ruckus despite having found the doll. I inhabited my misery as if it was a well-worn coat, because I could, because I knew how, because it had kept me company during the early years. But the more I noticed that I could no longer use my face as my logo, the locus of whatever made me, the freer I felt. Without my face, my identity became undone. When I couldn't pretend to be someone special, when I could no longer coagulate the different parts of myself into a mask that looked cohesive and in control, an unexpected freshness whooshed through the door. It was like those times when I can't sleep and I am thrashing in bed, hot and sweaty and wound in a knot of feverish mental activity. A thought enters like a prayer. Go outside. Walk out the front door and look at the sky. Just for a minute. Listen to the night. If I can rouse myself from the hypnotic trance of what's wrong, I throw a sweater on, pad to the door, and step into the vault of night. Coolness. Silence. A million points of glitter. Heart beats once, twice, three times. The mind sloughs its frenzy, merges with the expanse. Dazzled by a world that bears no resemblance to the one of 10 minutes ago, the one I perpetually construct in my head, I slip back in the house as if I, too, am a pinpoint of luster from the boundless dimension, padding along some strange hallway, disappearing with each step until I fall back asleep. While I was without my face, when compassion was needed, it arose. When it was time for me to give a talk, talking happened. Everything that needed to happen, feeling, laughing, crying, thinking, sleeping, sitting, walking, eating, tasting, swallowing, happened without my face. Something I didn't normally call me was still there, although the physical apparatus I had most associated with being me was gone. This is what all the spiritual hoo-ha is about, I thought. This unbreakable presence, this loss-proof wholeness. This is what must be left after everything that can die is dead and everything that can be lost is gone. Since I was already at the retreat, I decided to use my face as part of the teaching. I asked my students what they saw when they looked at me. Did they believe I was still me without my face? Mostly I wanted them to use their reactions to my face as a way to explore what they believed about their bodies. If they gained 10 pounds, if their arms didn't look the way they wanted them to look, Were they still themselves? Besides the ongoing story in their minds about the way it should be, the way they wanted it to be, the way it needed to be for them to be happy, was anything actually wrong? What remained when they lost their ideas of what they believed they couldn't live without? Months before, we'd done a mirror exercise together. I'd asked each of them to walk up to the full-length mirror and tell me what they saw. The litanies of judgments were all very similar. I see humongous thighs. I see flat, stringy hair. I see a horrible double chin. I see arms that hang down to Montana. I see cellulite. It's disgusting, poking through my pants. I can't stand what I see. I can't stand looking at myself. My body and I are one. There is nothing good about my body, and therefore there is nothing good about me. Then I asked them to look again at their bodies, beginning with their eyes. I asked them to look beyond the color and shape of their eyes and to see what was seeing. For people who didn't quite understand the seeing what was seeing part, I asked them to remember, if only for a moment, what it was like to be a child before they began to label and name the objects in their world. What it was like to see an extravaganza of form and color before they knew it was a rose and could compare it to other roses. What it was like to come upon a treasure, any treasure, a rock, the ocean, their mother's hand, before they learned to label and dismiss it as something they already knew. Everyone immediately understood what I was saying, as if I was speaking a secret language they'd been waiting to speak, without realizing they'd been waiting. When they walked up to the mirror, they used words like brilliance, like precious, like completely open. I see wonder, one person said. I see innocence. People saw beauty and loveliness and a feast of color and shape when they looked at their faces, the legs that carried them, the arms that held their children. One woman, after a profusion of near ecstatic adjectives about her body and what was seeing her body, said to me, "Janine, are you hypnotizing me?" She didn't remember in all her adult life looking at herself with anything but disdain. I told her that I believed she'd already been hypnotized and that hating herself was the result. At our About Face retreat, most everyone said they didn't actually notice my face for more than a passing second. A face, it seems, is only the entry point to what is beyond it, to what one student called the essence of the essence. Not everyone was so lofty. One person said, "Oh, an allergic reaction. I was wondering why you look so haggard and old." And is this how you feel about your bodies? That it's the entry point to what's beyond it? To some sort of essence, I asked. Not so much. Not really. No way. Are you joking? Someone said, "What if I'm missing the essential part? What if I really am broken through and through?" "It's not possible," I told her. "Look again." Then I told her the story of the Sufi dervish called Mulla Nasruddin, who was smuggling treasure across the border and masterfully eluding the guards. Every day for 4 years, he would parade back and forth, and with every crossing, the guards knew he was hiding expensive goods that he would sell for outrageous amounts of money on the other side. But despite their thorough searches, and despite the fact that they could see that he was prospering, they could find nothing in the saddle of the donkey he rode. Finally, years later, after Nasruddin had moved to another country, the frontier guard said, "Okay, you can tell me now. What were you smuggling?" Nasruddin smiled broadly. "My dear friend," he said, "I was smuggling donkeys." It's hidden in plain sight, the open secret. Every day, we are in touch with that which is not broken. But we are so busy paying attention to the million details of day-to-day life that we miss it. Whether we name it or not, it is still there. Whether we pay attention to it or not, it doesn't go away. Think about a time when you were transported beyond what you normally define as yourself. When time stopped, when you felt the edges of ordinary life dissolve and a door open to another dimension. Maybe it happened only once, when you were in the middle of a rainforest or gave birth to your child. Maybe it happened when you were 20 and on drugs. Maybe it happens whenever you are in nature, or when for no reason you are suddenly happy. 5 minutes ago, you were dragging your feet. The sun was too hot, your kids were screeching, or your boss was yelling, and you hated your life. And then suddenly, you caught a glimpse of beauty, and it's as if someone opened the cage door and let you out of the iron vise of your mind. And not one thing has changed from the moment before, but everything looks and feels and is completely different. Among its many other motivations, compulsive eating is a reaching for, a yearning for, an attempt to contact the place that is already whole. When you ask people who are yoked to disordered eating about their motivations for turning to food, they say things like, "I want peace, quiet, to forget about myself for a while, to go into another zone." It's as if the knowledge of the expanse beyond the concerns of the personal is already there, and they are using food to access it, which, no surprise, leads to more pain, because although the attempt may be honorable, the means to reach it causes alienation, isolation, suffering. Eventually, we get so tired of trying to fix ourselves that we stop. We see that we've never been able to make ourselves good, never been able to accomplish ourselves into being someone else. And so we stop trying. We see there is no goal, no end place, no test to take. No one is keeping score. No one is watching us and deciding whether we are worthy enough to ascend. As one of my teachers once said, "You can't be stuck if you're not trying to get anywhere." Eventually, we see that it was the investment in the brokenness, the constant effort to fix ourselves, that was the very thing that kept the wholeness at bay. If you think that your job is to fix what is broken, you keep finding more broken places to mend. It's better than being out of a job, especially in this economy. From one of my students. During the retreat, I realized how much I have done to make up for being myself, how much I have strived and efforted to counter what I believe is wrong. I realized that no one is fundamentally damaged, that every baby is born with an intact sense of being themselves, but the architecture of my nervous system seems to be skewed in a particular direction. I have to make up for being myself. I can't listen to impulses because if I, the damaged one, am having them, they must be damaged. And therefore, I have to do exactly what I don't want to do. Because if it's hard, if I suffer, it must be the right thing. The hardness, the suffering, will somehow clean the slate, cleanse the damage. So much of my longing to awaken has come from a desire to be good. Like there's a big mother in the sky who is watching what I do and giving me gold stars for getting up every day and meditating, for working on myself so much, so hard, and for so many years. I feel as if I need to find out what I am doing for self-expression and what I am doing for self-improvement, what I am doing because it's an effulgence, and what I am doing to get something that I don't believe I have, to be someone I don't believe I am. I tired enough of the search and not finding anything that I am giving it up. It's scary to say that. It's kind of like the moment I gave up dieting. I felt as if I was committing a sin by announcing to the world, myself, that I could trust myself. Now it's a different kind of giving up, the attempt to atone for being born as me. But I'm ready. I can feel it in my bones. I no longer believe that I am broken, or that if I am, there is any way of fixing it. Of this I am certain. Something happens every time I stop fighting with the way things are. Something happens to every one of my students when they stop running their familiar programs about fear and deficiency and emptiness. I don't know what to call this turn of events or the freshness that follows it, but I know what it feels like. It feels like relief. It feels like infinite goodness, like a distillation of every sweet fragrance, every heart-stopping beauty, every haunting melody you've ever heard. It feels like the essence of tenderness, compassion, joy, peace, like love itself. And in the moment you feel it, you recognize that you are it and that you've been here all along, waiting for your return. When you forget, which you always do, you suddenly understand that kindness to anyone, a plant, an animal, a stranger, a partner, brings you closer to this. That taking care of your body is taking care of this. That taking care of the earth is taking care of this. And that you turn away from anything or anyone that asked you to leave this because this is what you've wanted. This is what you've longed for. This is what you've loved for eons. You know without knowing how you know that every step you've ever taken, every person you've ever loved, every task you've ever accomplished has been this meeting this, you returning to yourself. And that hell is nothing more than leaving this. Heaven is already here on earth.